Barkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Enterprise BUS 100, Section 6 for Spring Semester 2011. Special Lecture 1, delivered on February 15, 2011. The title of this lecture is Business Entities.
Today, business entities. The human endeavor, the human activity of enterprise is as old as humans, as a subspecies are. It's even possible that some of our ancestors, the Neanderthals, engaged in enterprise. But there is no question that business has been going on among humans and involving humans for millennia, for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. Long before recorded history, people were doing things to make, for lack of a better term, money. Although money might be a relatively new phenomenon in human history, we have certainly been doing business, thing of value, for a long, long time. I can even tell you stories about how we know this has been going on. In this part of the country, for example, we know that there was a trade route of the Native Americans thousands of years ago. The Native Americans of the South and the Native Americans north of here were trading goods back and forth in a regular commercial pattern. How do we know this? Because we see materials and objects in the north that couldn't possibly have been found there. They come from the south. We find things in the south, manufactured goods and raw goods that were not there. They have to have been bartered, traded. And like I said, this is just one example. We know this has been happening all over the world. People do things to make money or to get value. We specialize in what we do best, given the resources available to us, given our own talents, and we then trade with others who can do something else better that we need. They need what we can do better. We need what they can do better. That's the beginnings of commerce. Let me put it this way. Almost every one of you in this class has been in business. You have had a business in your lives. Some way you have actually, have you ever earned money? You reported all of it on taxes, right? Okay, cover up the microphone. But you were running a business when you did that. I mean, we do that. That's just us. And we even recognize that type of business entity. One person, all on your own, we call that a sole proprietorship. A sole proprietorship. It's one person doing something to make money or to make something of value. The sole proprietor has this wonderful advantage of being able to keep every penny he or she earns after he pays or he or she pays the bills. You get to keep it all. Pay your taxes, obviously. You don't have to share it. But the downside of that is that you are all at risk in that endeavor. You decide that you've got a nice big truck. You bought it because you thought you could get girlfriends with it. You found out that didn't work. So now you get people to pay you money and you haul their stuff, furniture around and stuff like that. So there you are. You are in business. Okay, well now, you've moved some furniture for me. And I say, okay, how much do you
are you charging me to move that baby grand piano? A lot. Don't give me a specific. Are you out of your mind? What is this? You know, my God, my ancestors were Jewish. Yours weren't. Stop it. Great. Now the Goy are getting in on this. Okay, $100. Will you take a check?
No personal checks.
No personal checks? Yeah. Well, you know what? My parents, I went out with a Czechoslovakian girl. They said no because they don't accept checks. Mm-hmm. That's a joke. that's a joke. The hell with you people. God, no respect. Rough audience. Okay, here we go. Well, you might take checks, you might not. But okay, well, you take a check. Okay, well, make it out to me, you say. Oh, you can actually do it another way. You can have a name for your business. One Guy and His Truck. That's the name of your business. But you see, in that case, you would have taken on a fictitious name. Now, we have a term for that. We call it a DBA, a doing business as. A DBA, doing business as. Now, in some states, you could register it as a quote-unquote fictitious name. In this state, they use the term assumed name, assumed name. Now, interestingly, in this state, it's a little different from how I had done this. And I actually have two very active DBAs right now. Now, in this state, if I want to have an assumed name, I could just try to run it as an assumed name. That's not a good idea. But if I want protection and recognition of that DBA, that assumed name, it actually happens at the county level, at the county level here. The way it works kind of in a nutshell is you go to the county, the clerk, and the clerk's office. I think it was the clerk's office I went to. And they give you a form. You fill it out. Well, this is the name that I want to use as the assumed name of this business enterprise. And you give them your own personal name and your address, and you pay them a small fee. And they say, okay, well, here's the form. Now, you have to go and get a recognized publication, like a newspaper, to publish a notice that you are claiming this assumed name. And they have to do it for a certain period of time. If I'm remembering right, it was 3 weeks that it had to be in the paper. And so I did it in one of those business papers that you see near the shopping stores and all that. And they do this regularly. I think he charged me $36 the last time I did it. And once the 3 weeks was up, no one had challenged. It's essentially a public notice. Look, if there's anyone out there who doesn't want me to do this or you're using this, then you're going to have to say so because I am publishing it and you have access to it. After 3 weeks, I think it was 3 weeks, he sent me a little certificate, a notice. This person has published this assumed name for proposed assumed name for 3 weeks. I went back to the county clerk and I presented that and they said, okay, it's yours. And not only that, a couple of days later, I was quite surprised. They sent me a really nice certificate on hard cardstock saying, this business entity, this name is yours forever and ever and ever. I guess it is. And so that's why you'll hear at the beginning of my podcast, which I do under the DBA Dark Wraith Publishing, you'll hear Dark Wraith Publishing Presents. It is an assumed name that I created and I got qualified here in this county on behalf of the state in which I reside as a citizen. So there you are. You can use a DBA, but you will want, if you're going to do that, you're probably going to want to register it as an assumed name with the county. And again, that's a county level phenomenon, which I wasn't expecting because I swear when I lived in other states, you did it through the state. This was the first time I'd ever run into it at a county level. Maybe I'm just not remembering it right because it's been years ago since I created other DBAs. But right now I have two DBAs that are active here in this state that are recognized protection. Now that's not trademark level protection. That's not copyright level protection, certainly. But it is still at least something. And it's all I need for these. Now, understand that as a sole proprietorship, you get all of the bottom line profit for yourself. You get it. It's yours. You pay your bills. But there's another side to it, too. You are delivering furniture to a fancy house and you run over their dog. That's a nice dog. It was a poodle. Now, you didn't kill the poodle. You just ran over its hind leg. So they sue. They take your truck. But they're not going to stop there. If that's not enough to pay for fixing their dog and giving it a robo-dog leg or something like that. I don't know what they do with dogs. You know. They're going to go after everything else of yours. They're going to go after your hovel, you know, that Airstream trailer you've got, your Velvet Elvis paintings. Okay. They're going to go after those. Uh-huh. They're going to shoot your dog and take your Bible. Yes, they are. You see, because you have no limit on your own risk. You are all at risk in a sole proprietorship. You are all at risk. So there you are. It's got an upside. You are free as a DBA. And I tell you, that was one of the things that is attractive about a DBA to me is I don't have to jump through so many hoops that I do. I have when I had corporations under my care, custody, and control. And you're answerable only to yourself. If you want to screw the pooch, no one else will care. Well, they will if you don't if you breach a contract. But you're not answerable to anyone but yourself. Again, the downside is that you can get your clock cleaned. You can really get your clock cleaned in a DBA. That's why I would not do a DBA for certain types of enterprises where there was a high probability of lawsuits or some kind of other exposure, a risk exposure. In the kind of publishing I do and in my photography work, I don't have a lot of points where there is significant exposures to liability. Now, certainly, if any of you have read any of my political and social commentary, I say some pretty fiery, incendiary, damnable things there. And I've been threatened with lawsuits all the time. And I always respond with a very courteous formal letter that starts with, "Dear, bite me." Because I know very well that in publishing, there's not a whole lot of downside risk. I can say a lot and get by with it. The next level is like a sole proprietorship, except it's more than one person. It's a partnership. Now, a partnership is slightly more formal. If you want the state to recognize it, you have to file a formal statement declaring the partnership exists. But a partnership is essentially a sole proprietorship of more than one person. A partnership is nothing but a sole proprietorship of more than one person. You have these general partners. Now, this is a general partnership I'm describing here. And the two of you, or three of you, or however many there are of you, you are jointly and severally at risk. The two of you decide that you've got a van, and you decide you're going to start a catering business. People on campus can call you, and you'll go and get food for them or bring them back and charge them a little extra for the food that you ordered for them. So there is a general partnership. You share the responsibilities. You share whatever you make over your costs of running the business. But at the same time, just like in a sole proprietorship, you're all at risk. The two of you are jointly and severally liable for what's happening in that business. So if the bills exceed the revenues, just like in a sole proprietorship, you're on the line for those bills. Whether they're just bills in the normal course or bills through extraordinary mishaps, whatever it is. Now, you can always get some insurance. And don't get me wrong, you can call an insurance agent and you would say, I'm going to need a BOP. And, of course, a BOP is a business owner's policy. And they'll see if they can BOP your enterprise. But even at that, that's going to be money. That can get expensive, a BOP canis. It depends, though. But one way or the other, though, you two are jointly and severally at risk. So if you screw up, you both screw up, okay, in a general partnership. And But at the same time, you have freedom. Not as much as in a sole proprietorship, because your freedom is circumscribed by the needs and demands of your partner. Because he or she will have as much say as you do in a general partnership. Now, there is a variation on the general partnership that is called a limited partnership. Now, in a limited partnership, there is at least one general partner and at least one limited partner. There could be more of each. Now, the general partners manage, and they can establish the terms of the partnership. And the limited partners, they have to sit back, they invest. They are not allowed to participate in the management of the entity. They're not allowed to. They must sit back and just watch. And they cannot be involved. Now, the partnerships in which I have been involved, in which I was involved back in the day, were limited partnerships. And we would have a couple of people got together. We would just work together, get a great idea, get all the plans, get our management. You do this. I take care of this part and all that. And then we say, all right, we need $100,000. And so we would go out and we would sell maybe, let's say, 10 $10,000 limited partnership units. And that money would come in, and then we would run our business. And we would get the business finished, and that would be the end of the partnership. We would share the money with the limited partners according to the partnership agreement. We would always take a good share for ourselves, obviously. Now, you would think, okay, well, that's kind of a nice thing. You make some money. Let me tell you one of the kinds that I did, limited partnerships that I actually created them as one of the general partners, low-income housing for the elderly. Now, back a long time ago, I know those were cut off, those grants and those loans. But back a long time ago, the federal government would give low-interest and zero-interest loans for companies to build low-income housing for old people. Essentially, if you're poor and old, there was this active program where the government wanted houses or apartments, nice places. These weren't shabby at all. And so what we would do is we would form a general partnership. Okay, we're going to build a low-income housing for the elderly project out here on this side of town. Okay, this is going to cost us a couple of million to put it together. It was a little more than that. And what we'll do is we'll get a lot of the money through these low-interest and zero-interest loans from the federal government. And then we'll raise the rest of the money through limited partnerships, which we sold in one case, or in a couple of cases, $25,000 a unit. We sold them to doctors, lawyers, optometrists, dentists. There were professionals who had made a lot of money. And they had 25 grand kicking around. They put it into our limited partnership. They buy limited partnership units. And then we'd run the partnerships and... I don't recall once in the partnerships that I created that we ever sent those investors a dime. Every year we sent them these tax forms for them saying, we've lost money. We lost net income's negative, and the depreciation, we're rapidly depreciating these things because they're a pile of crap, and so you're going to lose money, you're losing money that way. Oh, man, those people just loved us. They loved themselves, our partnership. They were constantly calling, you got another one coming up? Why would they do that? We were losing money. We were getting our asses kicked. And we were doing it on purpose. We knew these things were going to make money. Yeah, why? Yes. You see, we had people like doctors. A doctor, he makes $150,000 a year in real income. We sent him in the early years, you lost $7,000 on our project. He gets a right $150,000 minus $7,000. So that's $7,000 of his income he won't pay tax on. So we were saving them tax money, thousands of dollars every year for years. far exceeding the 25 grand they put in. They put in 25 grand to avoid paying taxes at multiples of taxes of that amount. And so we would run these, and then they would close, and we'd keep going with other ones. You see, that's limited partnerships don't always have to be money-making. As a matter of fact, the best ones for the rich. But you have to understand, you have to sell these to rich people who are in very high marginal tax brackets. In other words, they're paying out the ass in taxes. Even if you've got grandma and grandpa, I got 25 grand, we can put a kick into this. No, you don't make enough money. Your tax bills are so low as it is, you'll never benefit from this. You're just going to lose $25,000. But if you make a huge amount of money, you're saving buku bucks on taxes with our, and I'm not going to call them a scam. They weren't a scam. They were perfectly legitimate. They were wonderful things. Limited partnerships are out there all over the place. They are just everywhere. I did limited partnerships not just in low-income housing for the elderly. I worked a limited partnership for a movie. It was an indie movie, and it wasn't exactly what you would call a family movie. But those are very common. They make a lot of money, those kinds of things do. The limited partners, indie movies, limited partnerships for indie movies are very common. You raise the money, you get limited partners. And one of the cool things about these is once in a while you'll have a hit, and it'll make money. Anymore, they're actually making more money than they did back in the day, but you always got the loss you can give to your investors. But at the same time, there was also with movies, there was always a bragging rights, rich person, yeah, I invested in a movie, things like that. And you can't let them go to the set because that's too much like management. Yeah.
I see the benefit for the limited, but do the general partners do that for the
limited? I make a salary. I'm paid. See, I'm not in the business of taking tax losses. I'm in the business of making myself go buy toys on eBay and buy friends on Craigslist. No. So you see, though, that from the general partner's point of view, this is a different thing. And if you get into finance courses, even in my basic finance course, FIL 240, which most of you will unfortunately take from me, I will talk to you about how a lot of times in business, the whole trick is to create different classes of people involved in the business who are bearing different types of risk. I don't want certain risks. I want someone else to take those. I find a clientele for those risks. Then there are those who don't want the risks that I'm willing to take. My limited partners, they don't want to manage. They just want to throw their money at something and then see the benefits of it. So I will take that risk on their behalf, and I will take a really good amount of money to bear that risk. And then I don't want the risk that's associated with the actual stream of bottom line money. Okay? Partnerships and sole proprietorships have one very important thing in common that I haven't mentioned yet. Have I told you that you're going to die someday?
No.
You are?
Yeah, I
thought I did. You're going to die. It'll hurt like hell. You'll bitch, and then you'll go to hell. Or heaven, I don't know. I haven't read your Facebook page. But you see, if you are running your own business and you die, that's it. Game over. The business is gone because you were the business. You were the business. When you die, that business gets planted in the ground with you forever to be worm food. With a partnership, if one of you dies, by definition, the partnership is over. It's gone. Done. That's it. There's no other. Now, you can create arrangements to bring a partnership about. Say you are married and your wife is good in business. She would like to continue this enterprise. Truth be told, she was having an affair with your partner, but you know that's the way it goes. You wondered why he was doing deliveries to your house every day while you were gone, but you know your wife told you she liked the pizza from. Anyway, stop. Concentrate. Look, when you die, theoretically, you could create some kind of a deal where you could bring about a new partnership that was in the form of the old partnership. But technically speaking, that old partnership is gone. Now, you can automate the process and all, like all that, but again, with sole proprietorships and partnerships, they have a limited life. They are mortal because you are mortal. One time, a course sort of like this one, except it was a little bit more freewheeling for an older audience, I said, the downside is that they are mortal, these kinds of businesses, the business that you put your own ass into, you lean into it with your heart and your soul, you bust your extra butt cheek to get the job done, to keep the business going. That mortality is the downside, but on the upside, you also have a genuine soul in the business because you are the business, and as long as you have a soul, the business does, because you live by the reputation, literally, you live by the reputation of your business. Now I'm going to take you to the ultimate perfection of the business enterprise, the corporation. The corporation is an entity recognized by law, separate from its owners. The liabilities of the corporation are separate from your liabilities. You are all at risk in a sole proprietorship or a general partnership. In a corporation, as the owners, you are not all at risk. The corporation's bills are the corporation's bills. A court will respect that corporate veil. It will not pierce that corporate veil unless you deliberately and egregiously pierce it. If you were to go out and use the corporate credit card to go shopping, or you were to use corporate funds for your own purposes otherwise, then you would be giving evidence that there was not a corporation there. That was just a sham. It was a sham corporation. But if you are respectful of the corporation, its liabilities belong to it. No debt holder can come through the corporation to get to you and what you personally own. The downside of that is this. You will, as an officer or a director, ensure that the debt holders are paid in a timely fashion according to your contracts with them. And only after the debts are paid according to contracts on each of the debts do you as the owners have a residual claim. In other words, the debt holders have the prior claim, and if anything is left over, you have, as the owners, the residual, the residue claim. So in other words, in an income statement, physically you see that income statement flowing down from revenue, taking out the expenses, paid as they come, and then after you've paid those expenses and then paid your taxes, the net income belongs to you. So you would see an income statement with something like revenues of $250,000. And then you would see after that, minus the expenses of all different kinds, some of them you have to pay all at once, some you pay on a time period or something like that. Let's say that those come to $150,000. And then you have your earnings before taxes. So you have $100,000 that is now there. You as the owners are not allowed to touch the $250,000. You're not allowed to touch the $100,000. There's actually another line in there, interest, but I won't get into that. Let's say that we have the corporation is taxed at 25%. So there would be $25,000 in taxes, and then the net income of the corporation is $75,000. There is your residual claim. You have the claim to the $75,000. Now, the officers and directors, the directors technically, will decide how much of that you can get as a dividend, and the remainder is plowed back into the corporation. So we would say, let's suppose that we decide that we're going to pay dividends to the shareholders, to the owners, of $20,000. That would mean that I am providing you with $20,000. And the remainder I would send back into the corporation. You get $20,000, and then we plow $55,000 back into the corporate operation. Now here's the here's one of the kind of like the downsides of what you're seeing right there, is the see that dividend right there? I send you are my owner of my corporation. I send you that dividend. You know what? You're going to have to pay tax on that $20,000. That's your ordinary tax rate. So you see how you have a double taxation phenomenon going on here. Earnings are taxed once at the corporate level, and then if it's a dividend, it's taxed at the individual owner level. So double taxation is part of the reality of a corporation. There's a way around this. You can form what's called an S-corp, where everything is considered at the bottom line of distribution, so there's only one level of taxation, the taxation at the individual owner level. And I'll mention that again in a few minutes. But in general, you can see that these dividends are actually almost like not a good idea. We do them because the shareholders oftentimes get bitchy at us if we don't send them a check. But really, the bulk of the money we get at the bottom line we want to put back into the corporation because in the long run, that is going to grow the shareholder value. As I plow money back through the corporation, the shareholder value increases. And so, one way or the other, we have to have some kind of a dividend policy, a payout ratio, and its complement, the plowback ratio. But one way or the other, in a C corporation, you've got double taxation. That's a problem with the corporate model. Although the question we always ask is corporations are constantly screaming and crying about this, but at the same time, you know, really, you should be plowing the money back in. That increases the stock. That should, if you're investing intelligently in your company's business, that should make the stock price go up right there. One way or the other, though. Here's how a corporation is created. Now, this is kind of an important thing. A corporation is a state entity. It's not a federal entity. You are a state entity. Now, by our constitutional structure and this unusual thing that we have, a United States, by virtue of being a citizen of the state, you have citizenship in the country as well, in the United States. There was this big thing, brouhaha, over the last few years about what makes a citizen, blood or land. The issue kind of devolves down to the state, because the state is where your constitutional protections actually begin. Now, you have constitutional protections at the federal level, and by the supremacy clause of the Constitution, the federal constitutions and the laws at the federal level take precedence over the state laws. There's a little bit of pushback on that these days because our Supreme Court is conservative and sometimes swinging very hard to the right. But really, you are, as an individual, a citizen of your state, and by virtue of the treaty between the states and the federal government, that treaty, by the way, is what's called the United States Constitution. That treaty gives you citizenship in the nation called the United States as well. A corporation is similarly a state animal. It is a state entity. You will choose a state in which to form your corporation. That is not necessarily the state in which you will do your primary business. The state in which you form your corporation is called your state of domicile, D-O-M-I-C-I-L-E, your state of domicile. Any other state in which you do business, you will be your corporation will be considered a foreign corporation. Sounds kind of odd, doesn't it? But if I form my corporation, I am domiciled in the state of Delaware, and I do business in the state of Missouri, I would be a domestic corporation in Delaware, domiciled in Delaware. I would be a foreign corporation in Missouri, even though I did all my business there. Now, I've formed quite a few corporations over my time as a business consultant and as an independent business person. I always formed my corporations in Delaware, even though I think I probably was in the state of Delaware maybe three times in my life. And why would I do that? Why would I form my corporations in a state? Yeah.
Lower taxes?
No. Well, there's a little bit of, some states have ridiculously high franchise taxes. They count per share, nearly knock you dead. There's a better reason. Delaware is very corporation friendly. The corporation law in Delaware is a dense, old body of law. The courts in Delaware, the chancery system, has what the judges, quote unquote, who are so knowledgeable about corporate law. Law, both statutory law and common law. What it means to be in business, what the doctrines are, what the precedents are. This old, old body. A judge in Delaware would know the business rule like the back of his hand. He would understand it. I wouldn't have to worry about some fool not grasping the business judgment rule, which can burn a corporation terribly. Now, the business judgment rule, by the way, goes like this. When you are running a corporation, you're not going to be a genius. I don't care what anyone says. You might be a total asshole and make a lot of money. You might be the luckiest person on earth and make a lot of money. But the reality of it is that a lot of times you're just going to screw up. It's going to happen. You're going to make a judgment, and it's going to be an absolute dog. What you might find out is that shareholders might want to sue your ass. Well, you screwed up. The executives and the directors really screwed up, so we're going to sue them. The business judgment rule says, unless you can show that there was some phenomenal malevolence or otherwise some unbelievable malfeasance, the judgment was there. They did the best they could. Get off it. Move on. Grow up. That's what we want to hear in business. If we do our job as good as we can, we are going to once in a while fail really bad. We're going to make a wildly bad mistake. I can assure you, I can clock through very successful corporations and tell you some of the most phenomenal, jaw-dropping mistakes that they've made. The last thing we need is a court coddling owners, watching us every time we make a mistake and then trying to sue us. So I want a court system that understands business judgment rule. I want a court system that understands all the different nuances of the law. I don't want a court that's going to coddle me as a corporation. Don't get me wrong about that. But I do want a court that is mature, has a mature body of old law that's been there for a long time and has seasoned people in the court system that understand that law, and also people in the state legislature who also understand, don't just pass a law because some willy-nilly special interest group is bawling for some law that's going to make it very difficult for me to conduct my business. That doesn't mean that we should have a libertarian society, but I also don't want just everyone law every day when someone gets unhappy with how businesses work. Here's the mechanics. And I did these. I don't do them anymore because it's unlawful for me to do them. But back in the day, we get a group together that wanted to form a business, a serious group. And I'll get back to talking about seriousness of this enterprise in a minute here. But you get the incorporators. These were the people who were going to be the first owners of the corporation. It was such an exciting thing. If you knew that they were dead serious and this was going to maybe actually do something, you'd have that night. I remember down in Texas once, there was steaks and beer, and we were just talking about just how we were going to make our fortune. And we talked about getting the corporation going. And so you get the incorporators together. Now, back in my day, the document you created was one page. That was the whole thing, was to make it a perfect one-page document. It's called the Articles of Incorporation. Now, the Articles of Incorporation have in their body the name of the company, the name of the corporation. The business shall be conducted under the name, where its principal business location will be. You'll also name the statutory agent for service of process. In other words, some individual or some company that is registered to get any court documents or anything that would ever come along like that. So if a court needs to send us something, the articles can be looked at. Oh, there's who we send it to. And you'd have other things in there too. One thing is you'd have how many shares of stock, usually just common stock, the corporation's ownership was divided into theoretically. So there, I would declare the capital stock of this corporation shall be divided into 100 million shares, par value, 0.1 cents per share common. In other words, this is how many total possible shares could be issued in this corporation. That's not how many will be issued at first. Usually in the initial round, I would set it up so each of the original owners might get 1 million shares. 1 million shares for each of you. Okay, in your case, 200,000. Yeah. But that would leave us plenty of shares so that we could sell stock in an IPO or in secondary public offerings later to raise money. We'd have lots of shares still out there, not out, still in the, I don't want to say the bank, still there available, but we'd have a small number of outstanding shares. But that 100 million would be the absolute limit on the corporation. You'd also have a par value per share. Usually some companies now don't do a par value, but if you haven't had accounting yet, you'll see that kind of odd little historical artifact when you get to accounting. But there would also be one clause, one of the articles, would specifically state that the powers of the incorporators are dissolved upon the filing of these articles of incorporation. And the corporation then becomes governed under a set of bylaws, the bylaws of the corporation. Now, the bylaws are a large document detailing all of the top level matters of the corporation. The names of the offices of the directors and top executives, the duties of each of these, a lot of details behind the scenes, things like even down to what a stock certificate is to look like, what the font is even, and I've seen. So that if there's ever a top level question or dispute, well, does the treasurer do this or does the secretary of the corporate of the board do this? Well, let's look at the bylaws. Ah, there it is. Yes, it says the treasurer would be doing that. This is like a governing meta document, like the brain of the corporation at its beginnings. So the articles of incorporation would say, when we file these, articles of incorporation that dissolves the powers of the incorporators and hands it off to this objective bylaws document from here on out. Now, these articles, and I'm speaking here historically the way it was done in my day, I know there are variations now. We would file the articles in triplicate. We send them to the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation. And again, state. Now, the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation would then review those articles to make sure that they were in due form. And then, if they were in due form, the Secretary of State would qualify the articles. They do not approve them. The government doesn't approve. It qualifies. And the same is true for stock offerings. The SEC doesn't approve a registration statement. It qualifies it. The Secretary of State qualifies the articles of incorporation. The evidence of that is a stamp and a signature from the and a signature that the Secretary of State's office of the State of Incorporation stamps on each of the three copies. You get one of those copies back. And that is the birth of your corporation. Literally a birth certificate. With that stamp, the government of that state is recognizing the corporation as a separate legal entity, its own entity that is governed by its own laws and recognized as such by the state of this, of incorporation and by mutual agreement by all other states in the United States. It would be recognized as a foreign corporation in those other states with rights and responsibilities incumbent upon it in the states in which it does business. Once you have the articles of incorporation back, you will immediately file with the federal government form SS9. This is a there's a fast track that's been around for a long time. I thought it was so cool. You fill out the form SS9, and then you can call them on a hotline, the IRS on a hotline. They'll ask you for the specific information in some of the boxes, and then they'll say, okay, we've got all that information in. Be sure to fax us the form and send us a hard copy. And then right there on the phone, they will issue you your FEIN, the corporation FEIN, the Federal Employee Identification Number. In other words, the corporate version of a Social Security number. What you are seeing here is the birth and the recognition at the state and the federal level of a legal entity. Just like you would, when you're born, you would get a birth certificate. And then you would get a Social Security number right after that. This is what's happening with a corporation. You are really creating something, and it's not you. So most of you will have kids someday, and you will find out they are not you, as much as you would want them to be. They are legally and otherwise their own individuals. And a corporation is the same way. In legal parlance, we use the term person, and that can include a corporation. There was a lot of unhappiness last year when the Supreme Court of the United States struck down a campaign finance law that limited how much corporations could contribute to political campaigns. The Supreme Court said that's denying free speech rights to the corporation. And liberals and leftists were extraordinarily upset about this. They say, you're giving like a constitutional right to a corporation? What the hell is that? Even President Obama, in his State of the Union speech last year, he was looked right at the Supreme Court justices there in the audience, and he ate them an ass, a new asshole. And one of the Supreme Court justices who had been in the rule in the majority on that, he just sat there shaking his head and mouthing, "Not true, not true. We didn't give corporations free speech rights," or something like that. And the answer to that justice is bullshit. That's exactly what you did. Now, is that wrong? That's another matter. But understand this, that was not a dramatic, that was not something out of the blue. The Supreme Court for a long time has been inching forward in recognizing constitutional rights of corporations, especially with respect to speech rights. That's been going on since the 1970s. For example, did you know that as a corporation, you're allowed to lie? Did you know that? You can't go overboard, but if you take a business law course from me, I'll tell you about puffing. Well, let's try this. Cleaner than clean. Whiter than white. Now, is there such a thing as cleaner than clean? No. You will run into a field and jump in slow motion. You will suddenly be attractive to women. No, you are now. Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever lied?
Never.
You haven't? My ass. Most people, let me see. You got no. Look, most people lie. I mean, I've kind of stretched the truth. I mean, you know, I know a guy like you. You probably told girls that you're actually Justin Bieber, and you know, you carved the meat for Lady Gaga's dress. I don't know. Yeah, we lie. But did you know what? Did you know something interesting? We're allowed to lie. It's okay. Now, there might be social consequences. God knows I've been, you know, caught, you know. I swear I didn't have a girlfriend. You know, and she finds out I did, you know. Oh, God. But you see, it's okay to lie. You can't lie to a grand jury. You can't lie under oath. And it's probably not a good idea to lie to the police anymore. But, you know, what with those damn tasers they have these days. But you see, here's the thing, though. In general, though, aside from social consequences, you can lie. There's nothing against the law about lying itself. So why is it that we should hold corporations to a different standard than we hold the people who own the corporations? I don't want to go overboard with defending that idea. But know this, that the corporation is a legal entity. It can conduct its operations, and it must conduct its operations separately from the owners. That's why when you talk about my corporation, bullshit. The corporation is not yours any more than a child is yours in some ownership sense. And as the officers and directors of the corporation, we are not the corporation. We are stewards, shepherds of the corporation. On behalf of the shareholders, who are the owners, we try to maximize shareholder value, which is a condemnation in a very material way of corporations that pay insanely high salaries to their executives. Well, this corporation wouldn't be here without an executive. Don't do it that way. The corporation is a separate entity. It will live or die on good stewardship or bad stewardship. But it will not live or die based upon some stake that the executives have, or the labor union has, or the environmentalists have, or the rah-rah right-wingers and conservative pro-business people have. We don't care about that. The corporation is a serious entity of its own. We maximize its shareholder value, but the entity exists separately from the shareholders. We give those shareholders the huge break. You can be held liable for the corporation's bills. And in return for that, we anticipate that they will back off the idea that they have some right to the claim what the corporation is or does. It is a legal separate entity. You see, back in my time as a consultant, I would get calls. I had a lot more chance for business than I actually took. I remember more than one where, well, we've got this great idea and we want to put together a corporation and just get ourselves started with our own a little corporation. We heard you kind of do that kind of stuff. No, I'm not interested in that. Once in a while, I would have some heavy-duty business connection say, look, sit down with them. They're just new. But if I did that, I made sure that the first thing was, this is not your toy. I'm not going to slap together a corporation just so you can have yourself a corporation. No, corporations are grave entities. Even early on in a corporation's life, it is different from a child. What's the worst that a child can do? It can shit its diaper. What's the worst that a corporation can do? Ask the people who were still alive in the ghetto in Bhopal, India, where a corporation wiped out thousands of them when a gas valve poured chlorine down on them and they breathed their lungs out. That's what a corporation can do. A corporation can start wars. Now, that in itself is not necessarily bad if it's a profitable war, but at the same time, you've got to recognize that people are going to die for you and for all kinds of other reasons. And for what you want, perhaps oil, perhaps minerals, perhaps water. But at the same time, recognize that that corporation as a separate legal entity is capable in its full power of projecting that kind of force on the world to change our destinies and to cause people to be better or to cause people to die. So when you form a corporation, you take it very seriously, because once you have filed those articles of incorporation, that little child has all the potential to wreck worlds. And it also has all the potential to create marvelous futures. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.